You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Broadway's podcast, where we present essential conversations with a curated roster of the best, most important, and innovative theater makers working today, from actors to writers, directors, designers, and everyone in between. We took our name from the title of a 1938 play by Kaufman and Hart that has since become a loving nickname for Broadway itself, always deemed on the verge of decline, yet always bouncing back, The Fabulous Invalid. I'm theater savant Jamie Dumont.
And I'm Rob Russo, writer and theater critic with StageLeft.nyc and Stage Left the podcast.
Rob, hello.
Hi. As you were doing that intro, I just kept thinking, wow, our title has never been more relevant, you know?
No, I feel like we have this conversation a lot, but we've taken some grief for our title. And as the year, this horrible year goes on and on and on and doesn't seem to end, our title seems to be more relevant than ever.
Right. I mean, not only is Broadway currently on the verge of decline, but we'll bounce back. I feel like we've bounced back. You know, we took a bit of a hiatus from this podcast for a variety of reasons, one of which included the election of Joe Biden, which I may or may not have spent some time in Delaware working on. But we are back. We have bounced back. And here we are.
Well, on behalf of anyone with a moral compass in this country, Rob, thank you for your hard work on the Biden campaign.
Oh, please. It was the least I could do. And it was good to get back into the, you know, the campaign mode and to feel like I was doing something other than sitting in my apartment and stewing or shaking my fist at the news, you know,
which is what I've been doing.
Well, you know, I think it's what everybody's been doing. But the good news is we are back. And with this episode, we're launching our third season.
We are going to kind of pivot a tiny bit, and the theme of this season is really going to be our favorite things.
I love that. Of course, you know, we're going to talk to theater makers that we love, but we'll also do some special episodes on shows and legendary figures that we admire.
Speaking of a theater maker that we love, speaking of somebody that we admire, today we are delighted to be joined by the one and only Vanessa Williams.
Yes, oh my gosh. But before we get to Vanessa, or Miss Williams, I should say, we do want to take a moment to congratulate our beloved Jennifer Simard on launching a new podcast with Jessica Vosk entitled Killing It on Broadway. It's a true crime comedy podcast in which they interview a different Broadway personality and talk about one infamous true crime case from their guest's home state.
And who doesn't love murder and Broadway? We're excited for Jennifer and Jessica, but this also means that Jennifer will no longer be participating in our show. Aww. So we love her. We miss her already. And if you love her and miss her, which I know you do, you can find her on Killing It on Broadway on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. And I just have to put a little commercial out there, Jennifer, if you're listening. As you know, I am connected to a very famous serial killer.
Future guest, Jamie Dumont.
When you get to Richard Ramirez, I've got some stories.
You're ready for your close-up. Well, back to Ms. Williams. I'm so excited for this interview.
Yes. As we all know, Vanessa Williams is a multi-hyphenate star of stage and screen with a career as a recording artist, actor, singer, and fashion designer. She made history as the first woman of African-American descent to receive the Miss America title when she was crowned Miss America 1984 in 1983 before launching her career as an 11-time Grammy-nominated recording artist with her signature song, Save the Best for Last.
Sometimes the snow comes down in June. Sometimes the sun goes round the moon. Just when I thought chance had passed, you go and save the best for last.
She also starred in the feature films such as Soul Food and Eraser, on the TV movie adaptation of Bye Bye Birdie, and playing memorable roles on TV's Ugly Betty and Desperate Housewives, both personal favorites of mine.
And of course, what we're going to talk to her about today is her career on stage. Vanessa made her Broadway debut in 1994, replacing Chita Rivera in Kiss of the Spider Woman. She returned to star as the witch in the first revival of Into the Woods and appeared in Sondheim on Sondheim, The Trip to Bountiful, and After Midnight, not to mention various concerts and other engagements along the way. Back in March, Vanessa was making her West End debut in the Donmar Warehouse revival of City of Angels when the theater shut down across the pond. And I have to say, that was the last show I saw in person on March 14th.
I'm so jealous. And, you know, we had tickets to see it in July.
That's so right. Yes, we were going to go again.
I love that show. You and I talk about this show a lot. It is one of those shows that has an equally clever score and book. I mean, the libretto of that show is as strong as the score, and that says a lot because that's a great score. There are some phenomenal songs in that show.
Oh my gosh, yeah. No, it's one of the best scores ever. Certainly one of the best that Cy Coleman wrote in a career of great scores.
I agree. And she's so perfectly suited for the role of Allura. So
oh my gosh,
we will get
yes.
to see it. It'll come back. I feel
yes,
confident.
Not only will it come back to London, but I hope it makes the leap to Broadway at some point in the future, because we need a City of Angels revival in New York.
We do. We really do.
And I think long past due.
Yeah, we're not the only people that feel that way. And I also have to say, I was fortunate enough to see her in Kiss of the Spider Woman. I saw her do it before I saw Cheetah on tour about a year after seeing it on Broadway.
Wow.
And I've been a fan of hers from the very beginning, from seeing her win the Miss America title. Her talent, she sang, of course, and her talent, which is sort of really apropos right now in the world we live in, she sang Happy Days Are Here Again.
Oh my gosh. Well,
And killed it. Yeah. So, you know, I think even then as a little teenage gay, I knew that this woman was like meant to be on Broadway. And I have a feeling when we talk to her, she's going to say the same thing. Yeah. She knew it her whole life long too. Because she's so good on stage.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Alrighty. Well, should we get to it?
Yeah, let's do it. Vanessa, thank you so much for joining us today. We're talking to you at a very perilous time for the American theater. Fortunately, we've elected Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to lead us out of this pandemic, but Broadway still remains shut down. And in the meantime, both the country and the theater industry is having a moral reckoning with the racial inequality that persists. As a result, many different efforts have been created to address this inequity. You're a founding member of Black Theater United. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how you became involved?
Well, Black Theater United started when I got a phone call from Audra McDonald right after George Floyd's death. And the U.S. was stunned. I think the Black community itself was paralyzed. And Audra said, I don't know what it is, but we need to do something. So basically, we called all of our Black talent on Broadway as a collective, including not only in front of the stage, but Karen Ford, who is a Black sound engineer, Kenny Leon, who is a Black theater director, Lisa Dawn Cave, who's a Black stage manager. We selected the elders, because that's what we are now. We're all kind of 50 plus, but people that have had experience for over 30 years in the business, that have relationships, but also, you know, have had issues. And we wanted to be a group similar to the NAACP, where we could highlight inequities, highlight how we can make change, and be here for the long run for equality, not only on stage and more Black programming, but also behind the stage in management, in staffing, and also, like I said, in design, sound design, costume design. Productions need to look like our country. And so that's one aspect. And what we've been able to do through addressing these issues, we participated in summits, which we have been a part of. One was with the Lord Theaters and discussed diversity within each of their theaters across the country. We have hosted town halls, which one highlighted Sherilyn Eiffel, who is head of the legal defense fund for the NAACP. We talked about how do you make change? And legally, these are what has happened. Showing up and being a part of the system works. And also Stacey Abrams, who's a rock star.
Oh, yes.
and Janine Abrams-McLean, we had a town hall with them, and we just needed to show people how important the census was, but also how important the vote is, and voter fraud, and making people aware of the system and how to maintain your presence in the system. You know, a lot of people didn't realize that. Why sign up for the census? Why be counted? Because if you're not counted, you won't get a grocery store in your neighborhood. You won't get more facilities in your local public school because your numbers aren't there. So it's been educational, and I think we've moved the needle, and that's what our kind of our mission has been.
Well, since the tragic events of last spring, which, you know, as you said, you know, stunned the nation and our community, so many people of color who work in the theater industry have come forward to share reflections on their own personal experiences, having worked in the industry, you know, experiences of mistreatment and racism and microaggressions that they've, you know, experienced in the workplace. As one of the most prominent actors of color who has worked on Broadway, do you have any reflections of your own that you want to share of experiences that you've had that have, you know, led you to want to be involved in this?
Well, my career has been one of always, I didn't know she could do that. So I've always been kind of, I don't want to say counted out, but having to prove my worth. And I think that's across the board, not only theater, but in film and television. There's been low expectations because of being labeled a beauty queen, labeled a scandal beauty queen. You're put in a box. So I'm a fighter. And every time I go into any situation, it's like, okay, now I got to prove myself again. The biggest theater lesson for me was, it was an 84 or 85, and Tommy Toon was in My One and Only with Twiggy, and they looked for a replacement. And my agents called me, Paul Martino called and said, listen, they want to replace you. Mike Nichols happened to be the director. I met with him, sang, danced, learned all the tap from Tommy. It was fantastic. And I remember walking into the theater and doing the audition and killing it. And Mike Nichols was in the front row or in mid-house, and he was like, great job, as I left. And I got a call later on from my agent saying, well, it's not going to happen. Years later, I ran into Mike Nichols at the opening of West Side Story. This is probably 2010. And he said, oh, God, remember that story? And I said, I said, yeah. I said, well, you know what really happened. I said, what? He said, Lee Gershwin was the widow of Ira Gershwin, obviously, and she was head of the estate. I walked in, did my audition, left, and Mike Nichols turned around to her and says, wasn't she terrific? He left and went downstage and went backstage down the spiral staircase, and the phone was ringing when he got to the foot of the steps. And he answered the phone, and it was Lee. And she said, over my dead body, will that whore be in my show? So I never knew exactly what had gone down. But years later, I said, okay, that was it. She didn't want to bring scandal. She wanted to sully her show with someone who was talented and who was worthy of the position. But because of what she felt, I was a scandal beauty queen, she didn't want to sully her show with me. So that was... I knew that it didn't happen back in the day, but that was confirmation. I said, okay, not only does it have to do with talent being a part of the equation, but it's image. Is some of this person going to sell tickets? And it took me a good 10 years from 84 to 94 to have success in every other way, have a number one single for 6 weeks in a row, get 11 Grammy nominations, and finally, okay, now you're worthy to be on Broadway. So that's my backdoor Broadway show story.
And the moon grows. grows dimmer at the tide's low ebb, and your breath comes faster, and you're aching to move, but you're caught in the web.
How did Spider-Woman come about?
I was called by Garth because they were working on, they were in Toronto doing Showboat. And they told my agent, well, Julie might not be coming in terms of the role, so you could get a chance to star on Broadway, not be out of town, but star in Julie, as Julie in Showboat. So I sang, fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, and sang it. And Garth was there and he said, okay, thank you, but we really want you for Kiss the Spider-Woman. Have you ever seen the show? And it had won all the Tonys that year. And I was living in LA and I hadn't seen. And I went in and watched the show and my eyes lit up and I said, jeez, I can do this. I can do this. And of course, Cheetah is a legend, and every role that I've ever wanted, Cheetah has done. So to get a chance to follow in her footsteps, and originally it was only supposed to be 3 months. It ended up being close to a year because it was such a success. And we also started a new company because they sent the original company on the road. But Brian Mitchell at the time, he wasn't Stokes, but it was me and Brian Mitchell and Howard McGillin all started at the same time. So it was kind of like a new, fresh show. And it brought in I think Howard had just come out. He had gotten divorced from his wife. So that was one thing. People wanted to see me. And then Brian had just come off the medical show that he was on.
Trapper John,
thank you. So we all had something to prove. And it was one of the special times in our careers, but it was just at the Broadhurst. It was one of those hot, sexy shows that just came to life with a whole different kind of vibe.
If there's a fire, don't bring me a home.
Give me some, give me love.
Call me a coward, that's true, I suppose.
Give me some, give me love, love, love.
But all I want is beauty, so hugs, squeezes, lips, kisses. So let's not make more trouble. Let's make
give me love, love. Give me love, love, love. Give me love.
I was fortunate enough to see you in that, and I have to say it was spectacular. But I can only imagine that there was some you felt. Some vindication with the huge success of your performance.
It was another opportunity to, I was labeled a pop star. Here comes a pop star trying to make it on Broadway. So all the people that I've done shows with prior to in summer theater and Syracuse and locally here in Chappaqua and high school, they all couldn't wait to come see me, but also see me succeed in something that I've always wanted to do in my entire life.
There is love, my touch, that is yours to use, and if you choose, just breathe my name, and there I'll be. Do
either you have stage presence or you don't. You can either sing or you don't. You can either move or you don't. And that's what I love. There's no tricks. And you got to really prove it to the audience, because the audience can easily see through all that.
Well, one of the things that's so special about your Broadway debut, of course, is that it was immortalized in a cast album, which is unique for a show that, you know, has already opened to do a second album. What was that experience like, getting to record the show?
It was wonderful, especially because I had a record deal at the time, and I was a polygram, so it ticked off part of my requirements, which was great, but also got a chance for a whole new cast to be able to capture it. And also, you know, those are the things, and back then it was a CD, but, you know, those are the treasures. You have your playbill, you have your CD, your cast album, and I remember listening to Pearly growing up, and, you know, I didn't go see the show, but my parents would come home, we'd buy the cast album, listen to it over and over again, like, oh, that's Melba Moore, oh, that's the song that I like. You know, so it just reminds me of growing up and wanting that tangible souvenir that everyone got a chance who saw that production.
And you're aching to move, but you're caught in the web of the Spider-Woman. In her velvet cape, you can run, you can scream, you can hide, but you cannot.
Terrence McNally right at the beginning of the pandemic. And obviously he wrote Kiss of the Spider Woman. And I'm wondering, did you get to work with him? Do you have any remembrances of him as an artist or a human being or your time on the show?
Well, I was put in about 3 weeks, which is usually if you're going to replace somebody's role, that's what you only get 3 weeks of rehearsal. But he was very complimentary. The last time I had any kind of dealing with him was New York Times did a kind of retrospective, and we did these portraits, and I got a chance to play the teacher role in Masterclass. Michael Ure did another thing, and we were all there shooting on the day, just kind of remembering who he was and happy to be celebrating. Lovely, sensitive man, so talented. And happy that I got a chance to work with him.
Hmm. Well, speaking of the pandemic and, of course, you know, the shutdown of theater, London Theater officially shut down on March 16th, a couple of days after Broadway did. And I have to tell you, Vanessa, the last show that I saw across the board was City of Angels.
You came!
In London on March 14th at the Garrick Theater. It was the last thing I saw, and I'm so happy I did because it was my first time seeing the show after listening to the cast album for, you know, my entire life. So it was such a thrill to see it, and it was such a thrill to see you on stage, which I hadn't, you know, that hadn't happened in a long time for me. How did you learn about the shutdown in London?
Well, I mean, it happened like wildfire. Everyone said, so we thought there were only a handful of cases in London at the time. I mean, the pubs were still open. We were still going out after after a show. We go to the pub and, you know, have stuff. So we knew that it was worse. We knew it was bad in, like, Italy was horrible. And we knew it was the wave was coming over. But I honestly thought it was only going to be 2 weeks because basically they're like, quarantine for 14 days, and then we'll all be back. So I was going to hang out and stay in London because they shut down that week before. And then all my friends, luckily came to see me, but a lot of my friends had canceled their plans because they were so nervous about coming over and hearing that it was unsafe. So I was bummed, and we were a week away from opening.
It's such a perfect combination of a really great jazzy score and just such a clever book, right? I mean, few musicals have a book as clever and taut and, you know, brilliant as that.
Yeah.
What was it like getting to work, you know, with that material? I know, unfortunately, you didn't get to open, but you did get to, I mean, clearly, as, you know, as we know, the show was in such great shape. What was it like, you know, sort of developing it and rehearsing and previewing in London?
Well, Josie Rourke was the director who had done it at the Dunmar warehouse about three years ago, and it sold out immediately. It was the hottest ticket in town. And Nika Burns, who owns NIMAX Theater, she said, "I want to do the proper, you know, theatrical version of it in the big theater." So we moved into the Garrick years later, and Josie called me that previous summer. I guess it was last summer, last August, and said, "I'm doing this. I would love for you to be my Laura Kingsley, and I think you'd be perfect." And I had never seen a production either because I was living in LA at the time. So, but my friend Doug Tompos from Syracuse, who went to Syracuse University with me, he was in the show. So, you know, and the score is so, so good. It's, I mean, I only have really one juicy song in it, but I get a chance to play. And again, it's for people that don't know the show, it's two different worlds. It's a story of a making of the movie in a film noir setting. So you've got the actual black and white movie that you're doing, and then you've got the color world of making of the movie. And Josie, which I think you'll agree, did a spectacular job at making you believe it through lighting, through costume, through effects. So you really felt like you're watching the movie. And then you get to the bright color and you knew that you were in this time period in Hollywood. So I love the fact that she's so brilliant, so obsessed with getting it right, but making it updated in terms of what we have available for technology nowadays with projections and sound, which is also great. And also the casting, thinking outside the box. I know you saw Theo James, who my daughter burst into tears on her way to London because, you know, I said, "Yeah, here's the cast. Rosalie Craig, Theo James." Like, "Mom, Theo James?" And she's like, "Yeah." I said, "Yeah." She's like, "Mom." And she burst. She's like, "You have to prepare him for this. I didn't know. He is my crush." And she was like sobbing while we're taking, you know, our British Airways flight to London. But he's known, he's a heartthrob. He's known as like a teen idol from Divergent series. So seeing him sing, and he was the perfect Stone, I think you would agree.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I may or may not have texted Jamie from intermission, echoing your daughter's point of view.
Like, who is this guy?
Yeah. I was like Downton Abbey. I actually didn't know his full full credits, but he is the real deal. Well, we look forward to it returning and you going back to the West End. Was it a hard show to tech? It sounds like it was a lot involved.
Really hard show to tech, just because we had so many different. It's a dual level set. With lots of things that move in and out, and a lot of the same set is in black and white and some is in color. So you're like, "Where am I now? Okay, let me figure it out." So it was a hard show to tech, but we were almost there, which is the sad part. There are inklings that we will open again next spring, which would be fantastic, and possibly in a bigger theater so we can actually socially distance. But get the amount of people that we normally would have gotten in the Garrick. So that's what we're hoping on, because I think, you know, and the talent was, you know, Rosalie is amazing. I mean, and also Rebecca and Rosalie and Hadley had all done the Dunmar version. So they were all pros at it, but then having all of us there really excited them too. So again, it was that new kind of visceral feeling of like, this is going to be really, really good. And those don't happen a lot, but I can't wait to get back and have my West End debut.
Well, I have to ask, was this the first time you've done a musical professionally with a female director?
It is. It is.
Yeah.
Because I
always love pointing that out, because increasingly, you know, finally, women are getting the opportunity to direct, you know, big musicals. Yeah. And I'm wondering, you know, in the room, did you find that made a difference, having a woman as the leader?
Now that I think of it, Nika Burns, who is she owns Nymax Theaters, so having a female producer and a female director really gave us a lot of power. We heard a lot of yeses. We heard a lot of passions. We'll do this. We're here for you. Tell me what your problems are, what your issues are. Everybody had open ears. So, and she made us listen to Barbara Stanwyck's story, because Barbara is very similar in terms of her Double Indemnity role to Alora Kingsley. And it's that kind of sexy, strong, you know, no nonsense, but very alluring. And she's like, this is the genre. It's very specific. So, and a lot of young kids don't even know film noir, you know, Barbara said, they don't know that. So she was very clear about, this is what I want to achieve. And then she had us do scene work from other movies just to hear what it would sound like, to allow us to get into that vibe. And then she had so many references, which were fantastic. So you can kind of click it in while you're doing your character work. But it was wonderful. And I can't wait to work with her again. And she also did Mary Queen of Scots, which is one of my favorite movies. Beautifully cinematic, but also a very strong feminist movie as well. And Saoirse Ronan is phenomenal. Margot Robbie, you know, what she would do physically with Margot's appearance, and the layers, I don't know if you've seen it, but the layers of you know, pain and competition, I you know, that was all Josie. So now that I've worked with her, I get it, and I would love to work with her on something else after this.
I can't hear Barbara Stanwyck's name without saying that her greatest film, in my opinion, is The Strange Loves of Martha Ivers. Have you ever seen this film?
Mm-mm.
Oh, it is a B-noir film that very few people have seen. But it is the thing about Barbara Stanwyck, people don't know, is what a marvelous actor she really was. I think people think she was this caricature, but that's a really interesting note that her films were something that you guys looked at, because that's perfect for that time period. And that time period suits you so well. It really feels like you live in that world to a certain degree. Like it comes naturally to you.
Well, I love language. I love language. I love diction. My mother, my parents were both music teachers. So my mother was a vocal teacher. My dad was an instrumental teacher. So, you know, my mother grew up in Buffalo. She skipped from 6th to 8th grade, went to college at 16. She had a really dynamic voice teacher who got rid of her Buffalo accents with the flat A's and made her diction really impeccable. But so I grew up and I was always like, you know, banana, what's a banana? You're talking banana. So having parents as educators, everything was a teachable moment. And I was kind of that being educated, but also articulate was very important in our house. So I love words. I love accents. But I have tended to play a lot of villains or women who are, and I don't want to say bitches, because I try to make them as multidimensional as possible. But you know, like, it's always like the Alan Rickmans, you know, Diane Carroll's, the people that really use language, and if they're sinister, it's not because they're scary. It's because of the strength in which the danger lives in what they're saying and their eyes, you know. And I think that's what I love about language and linguistics.
Well, speaking of language, before we let you go, we can't not ask you about Stephen Sondheim. You have twice been an interpreter of his work,
yes.
First with Into the Woods and most recently with Sondheim on Sondheim. As a performer, what is it about his work that's so rewarding, and what makes it so challenging?
I first started singing Sondheim in college for song study. And the first song I learned was There Won't Be Trumpets from Anyone Who Was And when I saw Into the Woods out in L.A. at the Amundsen when I was on the road because I was living out there at the time. But when I was asked to, when they were doing the revival and I was asked to come in for The Witch and sing, it was like a full circle moment. Like, oh, my God, I studied him in college and here I am, you know, singing for him.
Stay with me. The world is dark and wide. Stay a child while you can be a child with me.
And then I sang for his 75th birthday out at the Hollywood Bowl. And then his 80th birthday. I mean, it just seems like all these, he's 90 now, haven't sung. I didn't sing for him this year when he turned 90. But 10 years ago, he was 80, and we dedicated the Stephen Sondheim Theater for him that night while we were doing Sondheim on Sondheim. And I've been to his house, his townhouse, and, you know, he's really shy. His work, obviously his work stands for itself, but it's such an honor to do well and get a compliment from him, everyone lives, so I'm like, what did he say? You know? And so Into the Woods was fantastic because he loved how I approached it. And I don't want to say he said I was the best witch, but he did. And and then doing Sondheim and Sondheim, you know, you're in the middle of doing amazing songs, and I'm singing with Barbara Cook, who is phenomenal.
Oh, were you just? Oh, were you just being kind? Not a day goes by.
It's those moments in theater when, you know, and people that did not know the show, it was a story of his life through interviews that James Lapine had done with Stephen, and the set was multi TV screens that had different, or not TV, but multimedia screens that had these interviews of his life, reflections, and we would come out to sing whatever was pertinent to that time in his life. And every time he talked about his mother, and the segment was when his mother was going in for open heart surgery, she sent a letter delivered to him that said, "Dear Stephen, I just want to tell you I'm about to go under open heart surgery, and the only regret I have in my life is giving birth to you." And the whole audience gasps every night. And then we were on a rotating stage, and we all come around. And then you hear, "Careful the things you say, children will listen." And you can hear people just sobbing and weeping and trying to, you know, hold it together because it's so true. He wrote brilliant music out of his pain, his questioning. And after the end of that, he said, "It wasn't me. I just took away her life." And it had nothing to do, for that moment that he's talking about, that puzzle piece, he realized that it had nothing to do with who he was. I ruined her life because she had other aspirations. So he took all the personal angst and why doesn't my mother love me? And what did I do? And it all kind of made sense to him in that moment. But for everyone else, you're thinking, how could your mother ever say that? And oh my God, now I get all of your the layers that you describe in your music and why it's so deep because of who you are and what you've come from.
Careful the things you say, children will listen. Careful the things you do, children will see and learn. Children may not obey, but children will listen. Children will look to you for which way to turn, to learn what to be. Careful before you say, listen to me. Children will listen.
So those are those moments on the stage where you know it's going to happen every night, but you can't disconnect yourself from the feeling, because as you know, theater is communal and it changes every night and the audience changes every night. Sometimes they're dead and that's when we have a good time, and or we get angry and like, you know, we're going to make you laugh or we're going to make you cry. Or it's like everything you say, they're on the tip of, you know, they're right there with you. And that's when you come off. I've worked with Barbara Cook. I've worked with Cicely Tyson, both women who at the end of the show, when they've had a good show, I'm arm in arm walking with them and they go, that was good. And they turn into like an 18-year-old and you can see the fire in their eyes, like, let's do it again. And I was like, that's what I want to be when I'm in my 80s. You know, Barbara Cook was 85. Cicely Tyson was around the same age. That's the spirit that I want to feel, like, let's do that again. That was good. We're good.
We had this good thing going. And if I wanted too much, was that such a mistake at the time? You never wanted enough, all right, tough.
Well, when we do get back to the theater, which will happen, I can't wait for it. You know, I think it's safe to say we'll be in a new and changed terrain. You know, given all that we're talking about right now, you know, the work of Black Theater United and other organizations. I'm curious for your reflection, your point of view on how we should consider works like St. Louis Woman, which you did at City Center in 1998. Or Showboat, which you did at Lincoln Center in 2015, you know, shows featuring Black characters that have a lot to do with Black experiences and Black life, but were written by white people. You know, I'm wondering what you think the approach should be to works like that in the future.
Well, people came before, Ubi Blake probably would be the example of who is a success as a Black man in terms of musical theater, opening doors. And I remember seeing the Hines brothers and Ubi back in the day, and he was really the one who brought ragtime to popularity. So in one case, there's great works that can be discovered or rediscovered and brought to a bigger audience that was not aware of Black creators making things that were neglected. And the other is for a producer to have the... because the bottom line is money. They want to make money. They want to pay back their investors, but you have to take a chance. You know, I was lucky enough to be in, I've got my Great Dane. I've been lucky enough to be in shows that were extraordinary. And even St. Louis Woman, we talk about, you know, Jack O'Brien was our director. We had an all-star cast. And the producers were like, well, it's a big Black cast. It's going to be a Black show. We don't know whether we'll be able to sell it. And this is, we're talking 1998. But then you look at Hamilton, which, you know, you can't say it's a Black show and write it off. So my dream is that we will be able to have the courage to invest in shows that don't look like, let's just do another version of, Hello Dolly again and again and again. But let's take some of these considered Black shows and really sink some money into them so they would have a life and people can and expand the audience. That's what my hope is.
Cross the river, round the bend,
much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. We have one final question, which we ask everyone. What was that show or experience that made you want to do what you do?
I would have to say The Wiz. I saw the original Wiz with Stephanie Mills, and I was sitting front row mezzanine. So just looking over the balcony, and she was probably, I think I was 12. She's probably 14 or 15, but, you know, similar age. And she opened her mouth, and I love the music, but just watching her, I was like, wow, this is something that I really want to do. And I was dancing, you know, I danced my whole life, but I said, you know, being able to do that and sing and be with a great cast, that, and it's also, and I also live in New York, so it was a train ride away. So I knew that, okay, I could do this for a living. This is a tangible goal for me. So I'd have to say The Wiz with Stephanie Mills was my real, like, oh, I want to do this.
Turn off the lights and turn on your mind. And I can promise you, you will find, you will like my plan. My sweetest fan, my leading man, anywhere.
And we're so grateful that you did do it, because we've been the beneficiaries of so many wonderful performances
thank you.
Years.
Well, we look forward to seeing you on the West End, yes, or in the West End, hopefully in less than a year from now. And thank you again.
Thank you
so much.
You guys have been great.
Happy days are here again. The sky above are clear again, so let's sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again, all together.
Rob here, that's our show. Thanks for listening. As we all bask in the glow of the Biden-Harris victory, we're still big fans of Social Goods, an online store that offers a curated slate of statement-making merchandise that gives back to nonprofits that are tackling some of today's most pressing issues, from Every Town for Gun Safety to Planned Parenthood of New York, the Special Olympics, and more. Listeners of The Fabulous Invalid can go to social-goods.com and use the code FAB15, F-A-B-15, at checkout to receive 15% off your first purchase. That's Social Goods, where every transaction comes with real action. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid LLC, and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Aaron Kaufman. You can find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at Fabulous Invalid, and on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts. Check out our archive of episodes and be sure to tune in next time.
Happy night, happy days are here again. Yes, they're here again.
Esther Williams, Miss New York.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.